My name is Mark Schwain, and this evening's forum title is If I Could Tell the Church Where to Go, Visions for the Church's Future. And I think the emphasis in those of us who generated this topic of investigation is really on visions for the future. Should explain to some of you who are new to Holden Forums how we work. Though we will hear three opening comments to get us started, this is not the format of Nightline where we have a panel of experts and then Ted Koppel Schwain talks to them and you listen. This is not the format. The format is instead a conversation, really. The point is to think together and help each other think through matters that are complex, matters that are on all of our hearts, and matters that we would like at least to get some help in thinking through and leave with at least a clearer sense of what some of the issues are. Seldom do we leave with resolutions. They will not be asking us for a transcript in order to remake the church on the lines we recommend this evening. So, in any event, we count on all of you to be thoughtful and to contribute and to help us inquire and converse together. So let me introduce tonight's panelists, all of them on the teaching staff. Mel George, first of all, two seats down here, who's been teaching a series this week on lay theology. Dorothy Bass, who is also a teaching staff coordinator with me, and the two of us are married, and she'll be offering a session tomorrow on Christian formation. And then Ed Schrader, who was one of my teachers in college, and who's therefore responsible for any mistakes I may make this evening, who has been doing Bible this week. So, without further ado then, Mel, if you'll start us off, we'll move around and hear from the others, and then talk.
It's always nice to go first, because then I don't have to wonder if they're going to say what I was going to say. I am not a church historian, but it is my understanding that the national denominations really began out of causes, and primarily concern for overseas missions, that many of them began out of women's missionary societies, that organized themselves in order to enable congregations to do something together, which congregations could not do alone, and that is to send missionaries overseas. I believe that churches, the national denomination, by the word church tonight, I mean the national denomination and structure. I'm not talking about the people of God assembled or wherever they are, but about the national expressions of the mainline Protestant churches. And although I think many of my remarks will apply to all the mainline Protestant churches, my own experience is with the ELCA, and so I will be prepared only to document what I say I think about the ELCA, but my suspicion is that it is true generally of the mainline churches. I think that the mainline churches have developed lives of their own, and that one of the reasons that they are in the process of dying before our very eyes in many respects is because they are now trying to imitate society and culture. I think if the church tries to imitate society and culture, it is doomed to die and probably deserves to die. And I think that is the fundamental problem that underlies two phenomena which I see. In the first place, at least for the ELCA, I believe the agenda of the church is too broad and is too unrelated to the concerns of the people in the pews. I will give you only several examples. I think I can give you many. Many people that I talked to were deeply concerned about a lot of time, effort, and energy spent by the ELCA in working out a statement about entering into full communion with the Episcopalians. That involved, as we poor lay people understood it, the possibility that all of our pastors, whom we mostly respect and admire, would have to go to Sweden to be reordained to have hands laid on from the apostolic succession. And the hundreds of people that I talked to about this issue felt that this was irrelevant, totally unconnected with their concerns, and largely a waste of time. That's an example, I think, of an agenda item. I'm not opposed to ecumenical discussions or to ecumenical movements, but I do not believe that that was a necessary agenda item for the church. I do not understand why the church spends so much time developing positions on social issues. I'm very concerned about social issues. I think the church has an obligation to help its people think about social issues like homosexuality, abortion, homelessness, economic justice, from the perspective of the gospel. But I'm not sure that the National Expression of the Church ought to try to develop a single statement that tries to represent the views of the people. At least in the Lutheran Church, we came about because of the conviction that the people, the individual people of God, ought to be able to think for themselves, given familiarity with the Word and participation in the community of faith. And I guess I don't see that kind of energy devoted to this sort of thing. I think the people in the pews want spiritual nourishment. They want to know that good news is being preached to the poor. They want to live as part of a community of faith. And consequently, I believe that the agenda of the church needs to be focused, clarified, and centered on what it is that the church uniquely does, and that is to proclaim the good news and administer the sacraments. I think, secondly, that the organization of the church, at least the ELCA, is too hierarchical, Byzantine. I don't think anyone understands the structure of the ELCA at all. It is top-heavy. It has no organic connection with the congregations. I don't know whether those of you that are members of the ELCA recognize that the church council, which is the governing body of the ELCA, does not represent the synods. The people on the church council are elected essentially independently of the synods. So there is no connection between a local congregation where word and sacrament exist and where ministry to the needy occurs. There's no connection between that grouped together in synods and the church at large. We have departments of the church, we have commissions of the church, we have boards of the church, and no one understands this. Sitting off to the side, we have the Council of Bishops, consisting of all the synodical bishops who do not understand what their role is in the church. I will guarantee it, because I've talked to a lot of them. And I think this kind of corporate hierarchical structure in a big office building in Chicago, it makes people feel that the church has nothing to do with them, their lives, their need to be healed, and to be part of a community of faith. I'm done.
Okay. Thank you. My profession and also my hobby is observing American religion. What's going on in United States and religious organizations and movements. And I can support Mel's claim that the disgruntlement with the national denominational structure, which he perceives in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, is also very much going on in the other denominations. In one way, this shows up in membership laws. The Presbyterians have lost 25% of their members in the last 20 years, and the national level of the church, that church has only half the budget in real dollars that it had 20 years ago, in real dollars. And so things like all kinds of missions are suffering as a result, campus ministry, new church starts, lots of things. The United Methodist Church is having problems, the Episcopal Church, the United Church of Christ, my denomination, the Disciples of Christ, all of them. When you hear about your staff cuts in Chicago for the Lutheran Church, all of these denominations have had big staff cuts. And the people who work at headquarters, I believe, are often demoralized and feel real concerned about their own jobs, their livelihood. They're good people who rose into those positions usually out of a strong commitment to the program areas that they're responsible for. And yet they're kind of adrift institutionally. People still give money in their local churches, but not much of the money goes upstairs. People want to see its results in local mission projects, and that's a good thing. But there are many forces going on in all of those structures which are weakening the national denominational level offices and their ability to be effective. And it's disheartening to those good people who work there, I think, in many cases. From the perspective of church history, denominational structures are really a very new thing and not necessarily an essential part of what it means to be church, in my judgment. Most of these arose, yes, out of mission agendas, but became incorporated corporate bureaucratic bodies at the same time that the oil industry did, at the same time that the social work profession did, at the same time that public schools did. Right? There was a tendency about 100 years ago in the United States and in the early part of the 20th century to incorporate, to organize, to rationalize, to get efficient. And that's partly what happened to the church. It's not necessarily a part of what it means to be church. And even today, there are denominations larger than the Evangelical Lutheran Church. Primarily, I'm thinking of the African American, the National Baptist Convention, two different National Baptist Conventions of blacks, which have very small national structures and do very effective ministry. The group that the dissidents in the Southern Baptist Convention, who are just about to give up on their fundamentalist taken over denomination, are in a sense starting a new denomination, which will have two staff people, 1 million members at the beginning, and will grow very rapidly as other congregations join. They're anointing a couple of seminaries that already exist and helping some others come into being. So that you don't have to have a huge structure to be an effective, even a mission-oriented church, I think. Now, I would hope, what I think is essential to the vitality of the church, you want to say, where should the church go? I would be looking to the development of vital congregations. And by vital congregations, I suppose we'll all have different notions of what that would be, but I would think of those as places where the gospel is proclaimed clearly enough, the living Christ is present, such that people encounter a reality that challenges and that can form them in distinction to what the culture is trying to do. So that they're the kinds of status notions and the materialism, the consumerism of our culture, the individualism of our culture is really challenged in a vital congregation through the reality of that is encountered there in text, in liturgy, in common life. Where disciplines are learned that can then shape our lives to enable us to be faithful to that reality out in the world. And ways of thinking are formed that can help us then be faithful out in the world. And really from which a mission goes forth through our lives. A mission to the, can I say, pagan culture within which we live. Now the question would be whether, if vital congregations is where we want the church to go, can denominational structures be the way to get there? The agency of denominational input. And I would hope that this could be so. It could be, for instance, if the denomination decided to devote itself to that agenda. But frankly, I don't see that happening in any of the mainline denominations. I don't see that the denominational structures and offices are going to be in a position to really take that agenda on. There are too many vested interests. I mean, each person who works there is protecting a certain program area. You know, you try to get them talking about the overall mission of the church, and this one can't even be honest because they're sticking up for social justice over against this group of concerns, over against that group of concerns in a state of shrinking resources. What I would hope for instead is that the emergence of alternative, I would say movements, church renewal movements, places of church renewal. Because congregations can't just do this vitality by themselves. They do need inspiration, connection, input from other contacts that they have. And it seems to me that places like, well, this has happened in other religious movements. The Methodist movement was a movement within the Church of England to gain true piety and to serve the poor. Okay? And it revitalized a lot of congregations. Ultimately, they split off, but who cares? I mean, you know, they were vital, they were real, they were Christian. Sometimes you'll see something like a seminary emerge as a leader of a renewal movement. This happened, whatever your theology, and I'm not necessarily endorsing this, but Fuller Seminary represents a renewal movement within American evangelicalism. Okay? So there are possibilities of, and that are not just denominationally focused, but that can carry forward certain historic streams. And it's possible that places like Holden can be those kinds of places of connection and reinvigoration, it seems to me, that can let congregations have access to resources, new ideas, friendships that transcend their own local parochialism, that can become places of, so such that their vitality is inspired through their connection to other congregations.
Thank you. Ed?
If I could tell the church, and I'm thinking primarily of my own ELCA church leaders, where our church ought to go, what I have to say would be as simple as ABC. A is for the word authority, B is for the word bureaucracy, and I still can't figure out a catchy C for this third one, but maybe I'll come up with one in 3 or 4 minutes. For this first one on authority, I have, as usual, a Bible passage. It's the episode that you all know. It's my contention that the American corporate model, which all denominations have, is clean contrary to what Jesus said about the organization of the church. Clean contrary. 180 degrees wrong. You remember the episode, the sons of Zebedee, or in one of the references, it's Mama Zebedee herself came up to Jesus just before they marched to Jerusalem and he was crucified and said, when you come into your kingdom, can one of my boys here and one of my boy there be on your left-hand side and right-hand side? And Jesus said, sorry, that's not mine to designate. And then when the rest of the disciples heard it, they were mad because these two guys had beat him out for first crack at it. And then when the 10 heard it, they were, this is Matthew 20, verse 20. When the 10 heard it, they were angry with the first two brothers. But Jesus called them together and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles exercise authority over one another, and their greater ones are authorities over the lesser ones. But it shall not be so among you. But whoever wishes to be the great one among you must be the servant. The Greek word is slave. And whoever wishes to be first among you must be the one who serves everybody, just as the Son of Man came, not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. You've heard that umpteen times. The American corporate model of authority is, you know, the pyramid or the triangle. There's only one fine at the top, and there's more farther down, and it's top down, and that's hierarchy, we say. That's an old word that says that the priests are the ones in charge. But Jesus' model says it shall not be so among you, so it's the exact opposite. The authority figure, at least he, the authority in the church, says I'm at the bottom of the pile. And if you want to count, you know, sort of brownie points count not as how many people you have beneath you, but how many people are you holding up and supporting and caring and nurturing. Now the dilemma for Christians of all ages is how to concretize something like this in a world that always runs like this. And not many folks have done very well at it. Some Christian groups have never even bothered to try. Some of the, and once the bishops of the ancient church got to be big shots, and the Bishop of Rome got to be the biggest big shot of them all, the Western church at least was stuck with this. And this is still the crying dilemma of the Church of Rome, that is so set that the folks who are suffering and objecting down here cannot find any way to make it work. And they're walking out in droves, even if they stay inside the church. The Pope's no longer their authority by a long shot. Well, there's a parallel thing, I think, going on in all, at least American Protestant denominations, where the national headquarters are set up with this kind of model, but the folks may not be walking away in droves, but they pay no attention to what they do at Higgins Road or at, 575 Riverside in New York, or Louisville, where the Presbyterians now have moved to. I was jolted just a few days before I came here when I talked to one of the high mucky mucks in my former church, the Missouri Synod, Sam Napsker, who is the chair of the Commission on Theology and Church Relations. We were speaking in the same program at your university. And in some coffee clutch afterwards, Sam says, you know, denominations, the Missouri Synod is becoming more and more irrelevant for Missouri Synod people. And then he ticked off a couple congregations. He says, that church has a big one in, I think, Park Ridge, Illinois. That big one has its own mission program, foreign missionaries, its own education program, its own everything. They don't need anything that we do in St. Louis. That's at least one, the authority model is hard to implement, because how on earth, we can't even figure out, how on earth would you have bishops who in some sense, you know, would be at the bottom of the pile and holding everybody up, you know, who would report to whom? But at least that's the dilemma Jesus leaves us with. And he says, not because I just don't like up point up pyramids, but because he says my gospel is in principle a point down pyramid, and I, the chief, am the one who is at the bottom of the pile, literally giving my life for everybody and serving them, not having, you know, them serve me. Any church, at least in America, because they're all that way, has to reckon with how on earth to at least move towards something like this. I had these triangles lying out before, and Mark said, well, maybe you could sort of superimpose one over the other, and you'd get a Star of David, but then everybody would go to Judaism. And I said, no, no, and it's the Son of David, Jesus of Nazareth. You know, he's the one who says, impose this one over that one and work it out. A for authority, B for bureaucracy. Bureaucracy is usually a bitch word, that also starts with B, but I want to use it as in its technical sense, and I don't know too much about it technically, but bureaucracy was a new way to organize work invented in France, I think, in the last century, and that's why it's got the French word bureau in it, where work in factories and in governments, and also now finding our century in the church, was organized by having experts gathered together, having the whole work project divided up into parts that were somehow coherent within themselves, and then getting an expert to be in charge of that particular part. And one of the things in secular daily work that makes that sometimes tragic is that the person doesn't count very much. It's just if he or she can do the job, fine. If he or she can't, out, and we get somebody else plugged in who can do it, who can be the expert for managing that. Our church is set up bureaucratically. We've got, you know, division of this and division of that and division of that and commission of this and commission of that and commission of that. And the folks there are experts. They can do most all the jobs that they're supposed to do better than I could. Mm-hmm. However, being Christian is at its deepest level something that can't be delegated. I can't delegate my Christian faith or my Christian calling or my Christian acts of love to anybody, just as I can't delegate my being the husband of Marie to anybody or my being the father of our kids to anybody. There's something about the Christian faith that's non-delegatable, that I have to be the one who somehow does, quote, foreign missions and local missions and whatever. And even if I'm not the expert in any of this, Christ calls me to be his kind of man in whatever I've got in my place, you know, to handle or to somehow do that. Anyhow, that the aspect of the non-delegatableness of Christian faith and life is what I think has to somehow be put into bureaucracy, if it can be. Otherwise, bureaucracies have got to be radically turned around and upset, as they probably would be, you know, if you consciously said, let's really at least knock our heads off once, you know, for a trial run and see how we could organize a national church this way, upside, point down pyramid. That's A and B. The C is, I don't know what, it could be chronos, but that's a big egghead word, the time. What are the times now? Dorothy mentioned the time of the denomination may be past, or Mel said something like that too. I'm personally convinced it is. We in America have come to think that the church automatically is organized denominationally, because, you know, some people have Methodist prejudices or Lutheran prejudice or Roman Catholic, and obviously then they set up their own hierarchy. By the way, the church is not a hierarchy, it's a lowerarchy. Lowerarchy. Lower is better. Denominations exist primarily only in North America. There aren't really denominations in Europe. In Europe, there's basically two big confessions, you know, the Catholic one and then the Reformation one. But even so, denominations are only about 200 years old in Western, in Christian church history, and the church is 2,000 years old. That's only 10% of the church's life has, and a part of that, North America has been organized denominationally. And comments like that one from Ralph, from Sam Napsker, and from the experience of many of you of how denominations are becoming more, the denominational headquarters at least are more and more irrelevant, and the denominational distinctions and differences on the grassroots level are becoming more and more irrelevant. Even old line Missouri Synod, you know, stern and firm about doctrine, folks collaborate on the local level with all sorts of strange and wonderful other Christians and don't feel that they're, you know, fudging on what the national church says, but they're saying, that's what the Lord who's at the bottom of the pyramid pushes us to do. And not to do that would not only be dumb, but it'd be unfaithful. A couple weeks ago, Marie and I were in mainland China, where, as some of you know, the only allowed Protestant church, and there are two permitted churches, Christian churches in mainland China. One is the Roman Catholic Church that is, quote, patriotic about the government, and the other one is the Protestant church that is patriotic about the government. There are underground churches in both traditions, but the overground ones, and we spoke with people from both sides, at least on the Protestant, both kinds of the Protestant side. But one of the tags that's on now, the Protestantism in China, is the word post-denominational. They say we are now consciously working at constructing some kind of Christian community, Christian understanding, Christian mission and ministry, and beyond the denominations. To be sure, it's forced on us by the government, but that might be a blessing in disguise, and we're taking it as such and running with it. I think that's probably, if not the wave, that's a wave of the future of the church everywhere. And if it's post-denominational, then there ain't no need for denominational headquarters anyplace.
Well, I think that has started us off with a lot to chew on and think about. So the floor is open now. Let's get to work together to follow up the other part of our title, which was Visions for the Future. See if we can begin to fill out some directions the church may go. We've heard a lot of predictions and thoughts about probably where it's not going to go. So we're eager for your thoughts.
Well, I think that organization of the church is not the issue. It's a sub-issue. I think the fundamental issue is the substance, as Dorothy alluded to it, the substance of the faith. If you take Richard Niebuhr's categories of Christ and culture, Christ against culture, Christ for culture, I think we exist in a historical period in which it's Christ against culture. And I put it in terms of the need for another reformation in which the creation becomes the center of our faith. And we are reconverted or converted to a loyalty and a participation in the whole creation, in the whole world. And I don't know what Mel meant exactly by the denominations doing something unspiritual and making it social creeds, but I think the attention, I think one half of the education of a Christian, one half of the life of a church has to be in attention, not to what happened in history, or not even to what happens to us personally, although I think we're in such messes personally, a good many of us, that we have to spend half of our time on that. But the other half has to be spent on really figuring out how to be with and for and in communion with each other in the world of nature. And that task is not a task that's performed without attention to the concrete stuff that's going on in our world every day, to what's happened in Los Angeles, to what's happening in ozone and world population explosion and global warming and waste and all that. Seems to me God is saying a word to us, and we can't hear that word through the Bible, although the Bible says we have to listen to nature in order to hear its word. So I think the fundamental issue is the one of culture, and the church has to be a countercultural institution. A countercultural institution. It has to find a new way of being.
I'd just like to clarify, I agree with that 100%, and I started by saying I thought the problem was that the church was trying to imitate the culture, and I think that is the fundamental problem. I think it's very important for us to face, as Christians, the issues of Los Angeles and the environment. I do not believe the way to do that is to appoint a commission of learned people to sit in Higgins Road and try to write a statement. I believe the way to do that is to provide means by which local congregations and groups of Christians are faced with that word and with that concern and given resources, biblical, historical, or contemporary, wherever, to think about their responsibilities as Christians. So,
amen.
Okay, we're getting something of a shape here of the question, visions for the future. It looks to me like this, to lift up the themes, a bottom-up, not top-down organization for the sake of creating communities of discernment, which are themselves countercultural. So let's hear some responses, yes.
Just because forums are supposed to be two-sided. Mm-hmm. I don't disagree with much of anything that's been said, but we should just remind ourselves that the reasons that we have denominations is because our faith started out with people with a common Christian bent who interpreted the gospel in different ways. And I think to think we're going to go into a post-denominational era all thinking the same way is a pretty naive point of view. Secondly, I think one of the problems with the ground-up thing, and I agree that the top is lost connection with the bottom, is that I just went back to my hometown congregation in western South Dakota, and the congregation, the only thing that's happened there in the last 32 years since I graduated from high school is that it's decreased its membership, but really hasn't dealt with any of the issues that it should have over the last 32 years. And I think left unto themselves without some kind of inspiration that Dorothy was referring to, and I don't know where that's going to come from. These congregations blend so well with the culture. I think the main reason they've lost membership is because they don't mean anything to the people in the culture anymore. And I've always been impressed that the people at the top of our church are probably the most countercultural people in our church. They're the leaders, and they're the ones who are trying to push to the bottom. They just don't know how to do it. But left unto themselves, I don't think that our local congregations have the kind of leadership to pull that off.
Okay, let's hear some responses to that. The fear here is that if left to parochial leadership or parochial life, what would need to be countercultural is a kind of larger community which will kind of keep the local communities moving in a countercultural direction. Yes.
I think we can, blame our church for being too bureaucratic and top-heavy, but I think that that the blame there is sort of misdirected, because I think that it's more comfortable. It's more comfortable to delegate the bureaucracy to do something, to handle the problem, to give them the responsibility, because basically it's easier. It's easier if I hand over my problems to the bureaucracy and say, do something about it, and then if they don't do it the way I like it, then I can say, there's too much bureaucracy, you're not handling the problems. I would agree with the need for a reformation, because I think, I think the blame is with us, and that the reason we have this bureaucracy is because we haven't been handling it, so we appoint people to handle it for us, and then we don't like it. If they're not doing something, when it's really us that's not doing it.
I take that to be an underscoring of Ed's comment that Christianity is non-delegatable, and lots of Christians have themselves to blame for trying to do that. Not the people on top, but the people on the bottom who created the people on top.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
I think so.
Yeah.
I would just want to agree with a number of things that have been said, that I think it's easy to pass off this question as kind of a structural question. If we just restructure the church, somehow we'll be better. And that's kind of like, in my mind, being on the Titanic and deciding to rearrange the deck chairs, hoping that somehow we'll miss the iceberg. What's at stake here is somebody going up and knocking on the captain's quarters and saying, I think we're headed for an iceberg, and we need a fundamental change in direction. And I would just tell this story and maybe ask the group what meaning they get out of it. I'm aware of some Jesuit priests down in Central America who decided to go down to start a high school. And for the first 2 years of the high school, they taught school out of the garage that was attached to their house. Jesuits, being known for the quality of their education, soon it was intentionally focused on the poorest of the poor. The quality of education was such that richer people in the community began to ask if they could send their kids to that school. And with that, they were able to rent a bigger building and get things like overhead projectors and blackboards and all kinds of other equipment, and began offering a better education. What happened in the process of 6 years is that the population shifted from 80% poorest of the poor to 20% poorest of the poor. And finally, one night over dinner, as the story goes, these Jesuit priests, realizing what had happened, decided to give back the school, to give back the overhead projectors, to give back the blackboards, and they went back to the garage to pursue their original mission. So my question is, what will it cost us? How do we need to sacrifice to reclaim the original mission of the church? It's right in front of us. There's hungry people, there's homeless people. We don't have to look very far where I live to see the mission of the church, but it's going to cost us something. And my question is, are we ready to pay the price?
Yes, sir.
I like what you said, and it probably isn't the causes, it isn't the structure, that is the real problem. It is how we relate to them. Jesus does a flip-flop with our normal thinking when he says, whoever shall find his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life will find it. That our old self must die in order to rise. That's a flip-flop of all of our normal way of approaching problems. And just as that's true for an individual, so I believe it is with an organization. And that is that for an individual, often it's our strengths that become our idolatries. And so for institutions, it's often the strengths that become the idolatries. And then I say, well, what is our strength as a Lutheran church? One of our strengths is our theology. And probably not our theology itself that's the problem, it's the way we relate to our theology. I was in a discussion group at our synod meeting down in Eugene, Oregon, and we were talking about evangelism, and some of the lay people said, well, we don't really dare talk about our faith because we're afraid we will say it wrong. That feels like a symptom of the way we relate to our theology. I go to pastoral conferences and we use our theology to cut other people to shreds. There's something basic. So the question I think for us now is, how do we need to die? Just as those Jesuits said, we've got to throw out the stuff that we're hanging on to and discover what it means to let go and be reborn.
Anybody else want to respond to these questions about, in a sense, what was before us now, I think, is something like the cost of discipleship. In other words, if we can agree roughly to the kind of countercultural, bottom-up, more local image here, or communities of discernment image here, the notion is that the problem, though, might be with us here. Back to your point about wanting to delegate, and back to his point about Christianity being non-delegatable. And then your point is, but are we willing to pay the price? The issues are right in front of us. What's the cost of discipleship here? More responses to that. What's the cost?
I don't think you get at the issue by asking the cost of discipleship. I think you get at the issue by asking, what's the issue? And then you follow it. And if there's a cost, there's a cost. sacrifice is the wrong way to look at life, I think. The way to look at life is to find the center of your passion and what it is that needs doing, and do it. And if it costs, it costs.
I think that's the statement of a very mature Christian, Al, which you are. But I'm also concerned that another part of the church is forming people for that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the Bonhoeffer talked about spending the life of the church in service to the world. Okay, and I think that a church has to be willing to do that and to spend its whole self for the world. I mean, to let the rich students go and move back in the garage. You know, but there's another side, and Bonhoeffer talked about the need to participate in what he called the arcane disciplines. I mean, to constantly school our spirits for that kind of expenditure. I mean, to shape our minds. There are other forces that are trying to shape us and to tell us that other things are more important, mm-hmm. and to make us forget to pray, and to make us think that we can do it all, and to make us think that having more money is more important. And we have to also, I think, liturgically and educationally and personally shape our spirits for this task. When it gets going, it's mutual, and you get shaped in the doing. But there are new people need to be brought in. Most of us, even who are committed to these causes, need to remind ourselves again and again to keep, in a sense, spiritually centered, and mm-hmm. to avoid the distractions and the things that would pull us away from that, or at least I do.
And how are we going to do this shaping?
And that's the word and sacrament, that's the sacrament, the word and sacrament. Part of it is word and sacrament, and it's the arcane discipline. It's showing up even at the most boring church on Sundays, and forming people.
When you say word and sacrament, we assume you know what we mean, or what you mean. What do you mean by word? What needs to be done with word and sacrament that is going to affect something different?
Well, I think that there's a difference between structure and community.
Yeah.
And if we're looking at paradigms as to how the church is organized, it seems to me that what we're struggling is for a third paradigm, which is not the top down and the up down and the down up, but is something different shaped of community that speaks of community, that is not power oriented along whatever lines that power is determined, whether it be ownership, gender, whatever it is, but that the community, the new community we seek, does not have to betray our Lutheran identity, but may in fact speak out of it, around what the word and sacrament, and then how that gets played out among us. But I have somewhat of a problem with defining the community of the church with that which we know it as its structure, which is power-oriented model. Mm. When I see church, I see community. Interaction, welcoming, exchange, dialogue, suffering together, and risking together. And that's the only way that we can grow and maintain our sense of body. Or else I'm not interested in feeding the power structure. I'm more interested in feeding the community. But I don't know where we are in finding the third paradigm of community. There's a lot of people out there writing about it right now, but I'm not sure where we are with it.
Just an interesting point on that. I've been working with that triangle motion for a while. And, agree with it. I think one of the basic problems is we don't have a redeemed understanding of authority or power. I think we're really hemmed in our homework on that at all. But somebody was pushing me once when I was using the triangular, and said, but we need a living organism to best symbolize the church or and suggested it just off the top of his head, an amoeba, with Christ as the nucleus. So, I mean, there are some, we have to really wrestle with that. I agree with that. But I think, really, at the heart of this is, before we get tasked, we have to have calling. And vocation has been kind of a lost word that's precious in our heritage. And to recover that sense of vocation, of calling, we use volunteerism now and all these other things that come out of the culture. something in that area is as a source and beginning of renewable for us.
Yes.
Our calling needs to be grounded in the fact that we're baptized in Christ. To leave the discussion at the level of church as denomination to me is very disempowering. It leaves me feeling confused and angry and on the outside. But to think about the church as the people of God who are baptized in Christ puts us all on the same level. Not clergy, not lay, all of us together. And there's an empowerment or the possibility of that in that. And at the same time, there's also the onus of responsibility and conviction. To be baptized is not just something. It's great, and it's something we need to take seriously, and not just say it, but get into it in our calling and in our vocation. And thank God that we're all different and diverse and blessed with so many unique talents and gifts, but to use these to serve in that calling, whatever it may be, and how it can serve the community.
Scott.
Yeah, I'd like to pick up on something that I think several have said, maybe take another step. And that is that I agree that there's a big problem of irrelevancy in relation to the folks on the street and the folks in the national office. But I'm also frightened by the fact that some of the largest critics of what's happening denominationally are, seem to me, to also be the people that are coming from a place of having lost control and are trying to wrest it back again. And there is one whole segment of the church that has very much a fortress style of theology where they're going to define for us who's in and who's out. We've had some of those shootouts at the OK Corral at St. Olaf. And that I find very, very frightening. And rather what appeals to me is more what I think I hear some of the rest of you suggesting is that we may have to let this entity die a bit in order for a new paradigm to discover that is more relational. That allows the unexpected to happen. It gives freedom for discourse so one can tell the truth about one's own life and one's own experience and in a place of grace. I think we've lost grace in the church. You know, we live in a litigated society and we've suddenly taken that whole model on as our operative mode of doing business in the church. So we need these places of conversation out of which commitment will come to issues and people will organize in new ways. So, it could be a tragic mistake for us to find a new way to jack up the denomination at this point so that it, quote, succeeds unless we really are going down a new kind of path. I mean, maybe we could rearrange the chairs so that it would live, you know, the budget would go back up to $100 million and not sink down maybe or something, you know. And that could be the worst thing we could do unless we can address, I think, some of the issues that are being suggested here tonight.
I think that's absolutely right. I don't think any of us, the three of us, is interested in seeing one power structure replaced with another power structure, no matter how well-intentioned or self-proclaimed theologically sound. And I think the real issue is whether or not the denominations actually have to die. I noticed you used the phrase die a bit. I find that an interesting phrase. Is that like being a little bit pregnant?
Could you get a
just like that, come out here and die just a bit?
I think that's close to my own position. I'm not quite ready to scuttle the denominations. I'm afraid in this day and age, if we scuttle the denominations, we will all come out with sort of a formless new age electronic music multimedia event that I will frankly want to be part of. But I am very much, I want to pick up on Cindy's comment and Randy's comment. It seems to me that the fundamental problem is how much do the denominations have to die? How much do they have to change fundamentally what they are about and what they are doing in order to permit the community of the baptized to be empowered to do the work of God here and around the world? That's what I'm interested in. And I like your notion of community as distinct from organizational structure. But I think the question is then, how do we move from where we are now to that kind of vision of a community of the baptized who are called to be followers of Jesus Christ?
Well, I think we have to create the communities. I mean, it's clear the local churches need a lot of presence people who are slaves of Christ. And I want to make that point that Luther makes, that we're perfectly free, subject to none, but we're perfectly bound, slave of Christ. And the content of that Christ, which I consider the second person of the Trinity, is the all-important issue today. I'm not trying to deny the freedom that comes with grace and with justification by grace. That's absolutely essential. To free is to be a slave without using it for our own justification. But we don't know the content of that slavery. And that's the issue, and we've got to hammer that out in the local churches, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, I'd just like to build on that for just a bit. I think that part of the answer for me is wrapped up in the fact, I think, even the way that we frame this as a structural question, as a denominational question, I think is directly tied to the fact that we're a first world nation. We see the spirit, we see our destiny tied up in being powerful. You know, I want to wave the flag of Providence here. I want to wave the flag of this is the Spirit's church, you know, and if we want to know how to be communities, all we need to do is look to the south. they're doing it wonderfully well in Southern Africa, in Central America, in South America, and maybe it's time that North America was evangelized by churches who understand what time it is in the life of the church better than we can, because we're co-opted by our possessions.
Yes, sir.
Just want to return to the thing that Mel mentioned. I think one of the tragedies, some of us sat, you know, the new paradigm issue. Some of us sat in Phoenix, I suppose, the year before the ELCA formed, and heard a vision of what was in the founding documents that is altogether different than what actually happened. But the documents themselves contained the possibility for a new expression of the church, according at least to this one spokesperson. I mean, the vision was there. We weren't grown up enough for it. We weren't mature enough in the faith to grasp it and run with it. I just really want to say, you know, before we knock that ELCA totally, we have to realize that the possibility was there in our founding. And that puts it back on us, it seems to me.
Jay, are you speaking of the whole regional concept of the church?
Pardon me?
Over here. Passwords talk to you.
I'm deaf in one ear. I can't tell direction. That's one of my problems.
Are you talking about the whole notion that we were to be kind of a regional church and there would be different expressions in different parts of the country and that sort of thing?
No. That was one of the dimensions of it. But was more an understanding of redemptive power. A, the non-hierarchical understanding of expression of the faith.
Yeah, that's not primarily a form thing. That's a substance. That's a Christological thing, finally. How do you understand Jesus?
And that was there, according to this person at least, the possibility for that kind of expression was there so there was a non-hierarchical. Bishops were not seen as over, but as servants. I mean, that possibility for our organization in ELCA is there in the documents. We just don't know how to do that.
Well, and then Bill is offering a suggestion for one way to learn how to do that, which is to look, sometimes to go. I think that all the people who've been to Central America, I'm not among them, but that's the kind of non-denominational renewal movement that cuts across the Christian churches that has transformed a lot of people's faith and that has connected one congregation to another, not only within North America, but often with sister congregations in Central America, is the kind of new alternative movement structure as opposed to denominational structure that gets congregations out of their own parochialism. You know? And Dale mentioned, what do I mean by word and sacrament in this context? I mean, places where people can really, truly bring their pain, you know? So, I mean, communion, mm-hmm. Eucharist in the midst of a community which has just gone through something. And almost every group of 100 Christians on a Sunday morning has just, somebody just gone through something. Somebody ought to be going through something, right? But if you can actually bring the truth of your lives to that table, it's a very powerful thing. And we probably, most of us, have had a few Eucharists in our lives where we know that that's the case. And, you know, how can we help that to happen more frequently and with some regularity?
Renee, do you want to speak to this question? I know you had some things in your heart the other evening, and you've been to Central America a lot, and know a lot about what's...
I think I'd just be repeating a few things that Bill said.
Well,
I
mean, do.
I think that, well, we'll try it three times. I think our lives have to be interrogated by the poor. I think we have to answer. I think the locus of God's revelation is amongst the poor. And I think that is because they don't sit at the tables of power, and because they have a vision and a clarity by virtue of their powerlessness, which partakes of the life of Jesus. And I think it is an interrogation of our lives. I simply think we cannot, and we do not, and we will not have an answer. And I think until we enter into that powerlessness, not simply to give up power, you know, not a sacrificial notion, but simply that's the way that we encounter God's voice speaking in history. And, of course, I agree with Al about creation is another interrogation of our lives, because we've been split off from the body, from our source of connection to the world itself. But in any case, I think there have to be some guides, some roadmaps, and I think the source of that is, as you suggested earlier, I mean, where do we have to look? Homelessness confronts us every day. 40,000 kids die of hunger each day. Our cities are erupting. We would have to be people without eyes or hearts of stone not to see this. And the question, it seems to me, for anybody with any ethics or sensitivity is to say, what is to be done and how can I accompany the poor? I mean, it's not even solid, but how will I walk with them? How will I enter into that? And how does the church do that? And I think it means to go and die with the people and suffer with them. And it's not because it's a sacrificial journey. It simply is to say, will I be there or won't I? Where will I place myself? To whom will I listen? And so it seems to me that Central America has been critical for me, because I go there and I see where the poor have evangelized the poor. And it's a new church. And I come away with a new heart. And so, yes, I think the South is evangelizing the North, but we have to listen. We have to hear that.
So couldn't we do that by, I mean, we're in a large church now, but I see a lot of hurting people. And you go down to South America and you see the poor.
Yeah, it's here.
And what I'm getting from her is that what we need to do is, those of us who feel like we have some power and some joy and Christ has really been effective in our lives, we need to look at the people right here in our own congregations and really listen, pay attention to their pain, and then empower them. I mean, they're feeling poor too. So, I mean, I think it's very hard for them to feel sorry. It's not that they don't feel sorry, but it's hard for them to look at the homeless or whatever, because they're feeling so poor and so broken. So we almost have, it's kind of like what you just said. You go to South America and you see the poor helping the poor and lifting everybody up. And can we do that in our congregation?
Well, a quick comment and then just open it up to other people. And I think you're quite right. It's romantic to assume that people who are homeless you know, are not feeling a great deal of despair. But I think that the worst despair for the poor in this country is the way in which they're isolated from each other. This question of community is not simply a question for us, it's for this whole culture. I mean, community is a radical countercultural movement. I mean, every time people come together and organize their lives and begin to see that we is more important than I in this culture, that's revolutionary. Because everything militates towards individual self-interest. And so it seems to me when communities are formed, but I would go more, I would go further than that, and I would say communities of risk. And I think Paulo Freire was correct when he said that existence is risk. Insofar as I do not risk, I cannot be. I mean, so there has to be a way in which we step over lines, and they're the lines that the culture draws, but they're lines that are not life-giving. And I think that's even a civic action. I mean, insofar as you step over the lines, including the law, it is a litigated society. I think it's freeing. I think you take back your lives and you take back your authority and you understand that there are four branches of government, not three, and one of them is the people. So it's both a civic act, a political act, and a spiritual and theological act to resist this culture and all that it represents. I mean, I think it's a death culture. And so I think life is to say no to the state and to begin to say yes to life and to form communities because it cannot be done alone. No one has that courage. So risk is possible if we're holding each other's hands. So I think every time a community forms, I mean, it's a no to a culture that says you're alone, and it's a yes to life.
Fenn, you had a comment.
This is what I would like to say to the church is probably mostly based on feeling than really thought through. The church should preach the gospel and preach the gospel and preach the gospel. And not try to tell us how the gospel then, how our reaction to that restlessness that we feel when the gospel grabs hold of the church and tries to direct how we use our energy. And I think that's where a lot of the bureaucracy has grown out of that. A specific thing that I have been saying to the church by letter, because I can't shout clear to Chicago, is that we used to have a Department of Personnel, and now it's called Human Resources, and I think it's a terrible thing to use the name resources about human beings who are created in the image of God.
Yes.
Well, Rennie has had her program on Christopher Columbus, and we've seen the mission. And it looks to me as though, it's probably anathema, but capitalism seems to be, and our very system of following along with it, that we can't divorce ourselves from what it is we want and have. Our whole structure is set up for it. We've either got to unload that burden, I mean, we have to unload that burden, or I don't think Christianity and capitalism mix. I mean, from what she's shown, it does not mix. And unless we can do something with that, we're just going to continue on. I mean, tell me differently. Show me differently.
Well, that is certainly to bring us to a conclusion on it.
You mean I had the last word?
It ties into other themes, though, that have come up all night about countercultural, mm-hmm. about consumerism, about individualism, about the anodyne for this being community, which is both a means and an end of a certain kind. I guess I just want to say thanks to you all, and I guess I've been more mindful tonight than I am normally during forums of just where this is being held. You recall the name of this place, Koinonia. So, and you all know what that means? Anybody doesn't? Community? Okay. So, on that note, we've got a good conversation started. And
redeemed community.
Redeemed community?
I mean, doesn't Koinonia mean the community of the faithful?
The redeemed community, not just any old community.
Not just any old community. I stand corrected. The redeemed community. Good night and thank you all.